explains the unusual weather across the country. We've seen a mild winter and late rain in Northern California. More than 100 tornadoes hit the Midwest 2 weeks ago. And what about the warm weather on the East Coast? A few weeks ago, the organizers of the Boston Marathon issued a dire heat warning before the race. And then last week, New York City broke a 43-year-old daily rainfall record. So what explains all of this? On today's Your Call, we are talking about changing weather patterns. Last month was the hottest March on record since 1895, when records were first kept. What questions do you have about our changing weather patterns, and how is this related to climate change? Join us after the news.
BBC News with David Austin. The family of a Bahraini hunger striker jailed for leading last year's pro-democracy protests in Bahrain has said a decision to grant him a retrial in a civil court is a meaningless gesture. Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja and 20 other activists were convicted by a military court last year. Mr. Al-Khawaja's wife, Khadija Al-Musawi, said she did not expect justice.
If you know the judicial system in Bahrain, you will know it's the same judges in the military court and in the civilian court, but with different clothes. It's just that. Nothing will change. They're just buying time, and they want to tell the media that we are doing something positive now. They can't go through this again. They have been through a lot. They have been tortured. They have been spit on. They have been denied all their rights, so they have to be free.
At least 9 people have been killed and as many as 100 others injured in explosions in the Syrian city of Idlib. Reports say 3 large bombs went off, 2 of them targeting security service buildings. Syrian opposition activists put the number of dead at more than 20. Police in Austria investigating the death of a former Libyan oil minister whose body was found in the River Danube on Sunday say a post-mortem examination has found no signs so far that anyone else was involved in his death. They say Shukri Ghanem died by drowning. Mr. Ghanem was one of the most prominent Libyans to defect from Colonel Gaddafi's government. President Nicolas Sarkozy of France has said he'll sue a news website which has claimed that Libya's Colonel Gaddafi sought to fund his 2007 election campaign. The site published a document apparently signed by the former head of Libyan intelligence proposing the provision of up to $66 million towards the campaign. Mr. Sarkozy was furious.
This is a slur. A slur. When I think that there are journalists who dare give any credit to this, to Gaddafi's son, to the secret services of Mr. Gaddafi, it's a forgery.
A row is growing over the treatment of Ukraine's jailed former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. Ukraine has reacted angrily to reports that German ministers, led by Angela Merkel, may boycott football matches staged there as part of Euro 2012. From Brussels, Duncan Crawford reports.
With Euro 2012 just over a month away, there are growing concerns in Germany about the treatment of the Ukraine's former Prime Minister, Yulia Tymoshenko. Already jailed for 7 years for abusing power while in office, she also faces accusations of tax evasion, claims which she says are politically motivated. Images have been released showing bruises on her body, she says caused by prison guards. Ukrainian officials deny the claim.
World News from the BBC. Police in India say a passenger boat carrying about 350 people has overturned in the northeastern state of Assam. Reports say 40 bodies have been recovered. Many more people are feared to have drowned. A bomb explosion has killed 4 people in southern Nepal. Police said the blast took place during a protest meeting in the town of Janakpur, close to the Indian border. A faction of a local militant group, the Democratic Terai Liberation Front, which demands greater political rights for people in Nepal's southern plains, said it carried out the attack. A suicide attack on a police convoy in northeastern Nigeria has killed at least 10 people and wounded more than a dozen others. Tommy Oladipo reports from Lagos.
The otherwise calm city of Jelingo is now the latest scene of the ongoing wave of violence across the north of Nigeria. Eyewitnesses say a bomber on a motorcycle rode into a police convoy. The resulting explosion caused extensive damage to a nearby market and a government building. Reports suggest that a local police chief was the intended target, although he survived the blast.
Thousands of people in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo have fled renewed clashes between the army and troops loyal to Bosco Ntaganda, a renegade general who's wanted by the International Criminal Court. A BBC correspondent says a constant stream of families carrying mattresses, suitcases and cooking utensils is heading towards the city of Goma. Hundreds of troops who support Bosco Ntaganda seized two towns in the region on Sunday. The European Union has urged China to exercise the utmost restraint in the case of the prominent activist Chen Guangcheng, who escaped from house arrest last week. The EU warned China not to harass his family or associates. Mr. Chen, who campaigned against forced abortions, is believed to be under American protection in Beijing, but neither China nor the US has said where he is. That's the BBC News.
Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past few years, we've seen major changes with the weather. According to the U.S. Drought Monitor, a mostly dry, mild winter has put nearly 61% of the lower 48 states in abnormally dry or drought conditions. More than 15,000 daily heat records were broken around the U.S. last month, making 2012 the warmest March since records were first kept in 1895. In Northern California, we had a mild winter and a later than usual rainy season. 2 weeks ago, more than 100 tornadoes hit the Midwest, causing more than $1 billion in damage. The organizers of the Boston Marathon recently issued a dire heat warning before the race. And then last week, New York City broke a 43-year-old daily rainfall record. Earlier this month, a public opinion survey from the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication showed that roughly two-thirds of Americans believe global warming is linked to several of the extreme weather events and the recent mild winter. The environmental campaign group, 350.org, has designated May 5th as Connect the Dots of Climate Day. Thousands of communities across the globe will simultaneously take action to connect the dots of extreme weather events. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about the strange weather. What should we make of these changes? What explains the droughts, the heat waves, the rainstorms, and what is in store for the future? Today we're joined by Richard Somerville. He's a climate scientist, professor emeritus, and research professor at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. He's author of The Forgiving Air, Understanding Environmental Change. And Richard joins us from San Diego. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Kevin Trenberth. Kevin is a senior scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose, and good morning, Richard.
So, Richard, let's start off with you. First off, what are your thoughts on all these weather patterns we're seeing? A lot of people in San Francisco, for example, are saying, well, we really didn't have a winter, it rained late, and now it feels like summer. How strange is this?
Well, it's certainly strange compared to what we've been used to, but for climate scientists like Kevin and myself, it's exactly what we've been expecting. It's what our theory and our computer models tell us should be happening as the world warms up because of human effects.
So this is what you've been expecting. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, when the climate warms, and it is warming now, we have incontrovertible evidence from many sources that our planet is warming, and the science tells us that it's mostly due to human causes. When that's happening, we would expect to see a change in the odds. We would expect to see more high temperature records set than low temperature records. We would expect to see an increase in the severity of droughts and heat waves. And those are the kinds of things that we're seeing.
Kevin, what would you add to that? How connected are these strange events with climate change?
Well, what Richard said is true in a statistical sense, but of course there's a tremendous amount of natural variability from the weather. And so where these events occur and when they occur are scattered around the world. And in the last 2 years, the U.S. and North America in particular has been subject to perhaps more than its share, whereas previously, especially in 2010, Europe and the Russian heat wave and the Pakistan floods and other and Australian floods, all of the floods in Queensland. So they were occurring in other parts of the world. And, you know, these things will move around, but the odds of them happening somewhere is certainly increasing because of global warming.
And can you talk a little bit about some of the confusion that's out there? Because a lot of people are saying, is this just chance? Is this natural? Or is this connected to climate change?
Well, of course, even if the climate is not changing, as the record goes on, we will continue to break records. And we know exactly how many records should be broken. It depends exactly on the length of the observations. I think you mentioned the incredible number of records that were broken in the U.S. in March, over 15,000, I think. And they're all on the side of the warm side, which means they're in the direction that we expect with global warming. And in fact, we can keep track of that. In the past couple of years, the number of records that have been broken on the high side is just way far and above anything that would be expected under natural variability. And so this is a clear indicator that climate change is rearing its head. And when records are broken, you know, we can cross thresholds and things can break. And we're seeing some evidence of that. And so this is the sort of thing which can be very damaging as well.
What would you add to that, Richard?
I think Kevin has put his finger on it. There are a lot of metaphors that we use to illustrate these points, and one of them is the metaphor of an athlete who's on drugs. You have to look at the statistics so that if a baseball player who was a good player when he was clean starts taking performance-enhancing drugs, he'll still strike out now and then, but his batting average will go up or his slugging percentage will go up. So at a given at-bat at the plate, whether he hits a home run or strikes out doesn't matter. What matters is looking at the statistics and seeing how they change. If the climate were not warming up, we would expect new records to be set all the time, but on average, there'd be about as many new high-temperature records set as new low-temperature records. But because the climate's warming, it changes the odds, and we'd expect to see far more high-temperature records set than low temperature records. Statistically, we can make a forecast about how those odds should change. And when we look at the observations of the new records being set, it conforms with those expectations. So this is part of the reason why we're so convinced of the fact that the changing climate is the cause of these new records being set.
It was incredible to hear that the organizers of the Boston Marathon had to issue a dire heat warning before the race and tell people, if you're not used to this kind of heat, you really shouldn't take part in this race. So how concerned should we be about all of this? Kevin?
Well, with humans, of course, we can insulate ourselves from that by going inside and turning on the air conditioning, unless you're running the Boston Marathon, which has got a set time.
But, and you better be careful if you are running it.
But the key issue, of course, is the general environment, the ecosystems, the farmers, the crops, the risks of wildfire. And, you know, perhaps the poster child for this is, you know, what happened in Texas last year. It was just so incredible how many days they had above 100 degrees Fahrenheit, for instance, in Dallas-Fort Worth or throughout the state. And when things get that hot in the summertime, you know, it's one thing to be hot in March as it was. And, you know, it was especially east of the Rockies. But when it happens in the middle of summer, then things dry out very quickly, become tinder dry. We cross thresholds and suddenly wildfires breaking out all over the place with record-breaking wildfires in Arizona and in Texas last year and tremendous damage that ensues as a result. And so those are the real risks that we have to worry about.
And Texas Governor Rick Perry just renewed a drought disaster declaration in Texas.
He did.
Know, that's interesting because Governor Perry is among the politicians who've refused to accept the science on this subject.
Right.
And so he has the evidence staring him in the face in his own state where vast damage is being done. And he hasn't yet connected the dots. But many more people are connecting those dots and are coming to realize that what the scientists have been saying for a long time is true.
Well, and using Texas as an example, because things were so extreme, they endured the worst single-year drought in history through last summer and a relatively wet winter, followed by little rainfall in recent weeks. What does this tell us about where we are right now and what politicians are or are not doing, and what should they be doing, Richard?
I think it's time for politicians in this country to do what politicians in many other countries have already done, which is to realize that it's human causes that are behind this climate change, and in particular, it's the added burden of carbon dioxide and other man-made gases that add to the greenhouse effect that are the primary cause. The science has been quite clear on this for a long time, and things can be done about that. It's perfectly possible to greatly reduce the rate at which human beings are adding these heat-trapping gases to the atmosphere. And other countries are doing it. It requires some things that are very pleasant, doing more energy conservation and energy efficiency, which could put money in your pocket, and some things that require an effort, putting a price on carbon, greater reliance on renewable energy sources, and so on. I think there's a long list of things that can be done, and it's a question of bringing it up the priority list so that people put pressure on their politicians. They tell them that they don't want to leave a damaged planet to their descendants. And so we start doing these things. There's plenty that can be done. It's not a question of technology. It's a question of political will.
Right. And we do shows about this on a regular basis. What are your thoughts on that, Kevin? Just the action that really needs to be taken right now.
Well, firstly, as we've just pointed out with some of the examples we've used, the effects of climate change have a cost, and in some case, a considerable cost. You know, when we really cross some of these thresholds and go where the climate has never been before, and we get major floods, such as we had last year with Irene along the East Coast, all the way up to Vermont, or all of the wildfires that are occurring in Texas and across the South, and, you know, the stage is set this year at the moment for a lot of wildfires occurring this summer if the weather pattern doesn't change. And so there are substantial costs involved in this. There may be a need for some investment in order to address the issues, as Richard has said. Putting a price on carbon, I think, is one of them, but also removing subsidies from fossil fuels. The cost of the fossil fuels, you know, the fact that we're so wedded to fossil fuels, and they're really not paying their way, that the damage that is caused by this, both in terms of climate change and also in terms of air pollution, are what is sometimes referred to as externalities, you know, extra costs that have to be borne by the general public, and it should be borne up front by the in the cost of the fuel.
Well, and speaking of cost, do you think if we spent more time talking about the costs, there might be more attention placed on this issue? Because according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, in 2011 alone, droughts, floods, hurricanes, and other weather-related issues cost the economy at least $55 billion, 14 events costing $1 billion or more each. So you've got the wildfires in Texas, droughts, Oklahoma costing crop farmers about almost $8 billion on top of $5 billion to the cotton industry. And it doesn't seem like, I mean, this is going to continue increasing. Do you think that's the way to go about this, Richard, since politicians might care more about the money and the economy?
I think that greater transparency and greater honesty about the costs of doing nothing would be very helpful. And people have to realize that. We know, for example, that agricultural productivity overall will decrease as the planet continues to warm. And we know also that disasters like Katrina in New Orleans are not borne only by the people in the locality. They're borne by the nation as a whole. So you're going to see food prices go up. You're going to see insurance rates rise. You're going to see greater damage along coasts as they become more vulnerable because of rising sea level. And these are costs that the nation as a whole will bear. And so it's a little bit like surgery, you know. People wonder if they should do elective surgery because it involves, you know, costs and risks. But not doing it, when the doctor says, you know, your heart's ready to have a heart attack, that also involves costs and risks. So greater honesty and transparency, frank, candid discussions of these topics need to happen.
And we don't really have an overall climate policy in this country, right?
Right.
That's certainly true. We do not.
So how can we move forward on these issues without kind of starting on this, from the same page? And do you think we'll ever get there to have an overall climate policy?
My view is yes, because we did have broad concern about this not so very long ago. If you think back 4 years to the last presidential election, both candidates, McCain and Obama, spoke out very forcefully about climate change as an important issue, one that needed action. McCain at the time had been a leader in the Senate. Remember the McCain-Lieberman bill? And Obama spoke very forcefully, very eloquently about this issue. But in recent years, perhaps due to the toxic partisan divide in Washington, you don't hear it anymore. So it's been swept under the rug, and it's regarded as something that's not useful to talk about. That has to change. It has changed in many other countries. The U.S. has become an outlier in this area, and that's regrettable.
Kevin, what would you add?
Yes, that's the point I would emphasize, is that many things are happening in other places around the world. You know, even Australia has turned around. For a long time, they did not sign the Kyoto Protocol. China is actually doing a lot more in many respects than the U.S., although China itself is a major problem. And it is an international problem, but it requires U.S. leadership, and the U.S. is largely invisible on this in the international fora that really are required to address this in a fair and equitable manner. And something like the G20 or certainly the 20 most polluting countries need to get together to really address this issue rather than the whole of the United Nations. But U.S. leadership is essential.
And that is Kevin Trenberth, senior scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. We're also joined by Richard Somerville, climate scientist, professor emeritus, and research professor at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. And he's author of The Forgiving Air, Understanding Environmental Change. And today we're talking about all of the strange weather we've been seeing. What do you make of what we're facing right now? According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, since 2000, the world has experienced 9 of the 10 warmest years since 1880. So what are you seeing where you live? What changes are you seeing? How concerned are you about this? How is it affecting the area where you live? And if you have any questions about what is happening with the changing weather and what this means for the future, what are your thoughts? How can we really get politicians to take this issue seriously? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Kurt in Monterey. Hi, Kurt. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. And again, thank you for your program. I think it's an excellent program.
Thank you.
I just had a comment, and that is I've been a commercial pilot since the early 70s, and I've flown across the United States many times, coast to coast. And in recent years, I kind of shifted gears and started sailing boats offshore from Mexico and Puerto Vallarta to Hawaii, and Hawaii to the Farallon or to San Francisco, and so the central coast of California. And what I've noticed in the last 10 years is the severity of weather that has changed. And of course, throughout history, there's been shipwrecks and all kinds of things. But one thing that your listeners may not be aware of is that the boat that was recently lost on the Farallon's race from San Francisco, which was just in the last month, I believe.
Right.
There was 5 fatalities. It was a good-sized boat. It's a kind of boat that I have often sailed on. It's almost 50-foot carbon fiber boat, built very rugged, very strong. And, the point is that the Coast Guard, who permits the ocean racing, all ocean racing at this point in time, as far as I've known, since the last couple of days is that they have suspended all the racing out of San Francisco Bay to Ocean Racing points because there's an investigation underway as to what happened. And what I know, having just recently made a similar trip, is that the weather just seems to become more severe every year. That's just a personal observation. It's not based on anything scientific, but over a period of time, having done this over a period of time, it just seems like there's clearly a change.
Well, thank you. So this is based on your experience in the ocean, and there is a new study out that found climate change is accelerating the evaporation and rainfall of water over the ocean. What are your thoughts, Richard, about how climate change is affecting the oceans?
I wanted to send that question straight to Kevin Trenberth because he's the author of some excellent research on this topic.
Okay.
So I think it'd be better if he spoke to this particular issue.
Okay, Kevin?
Yes, the water cycle is speeding up. The paper that was just published in Science Magazine suggests that the areas which are dry are getting drier, and the areas that are wet are tending to get wetter. And so the extremes in what we call the water cycle or the hydrological cycle are intensifying. And so that does, in fact, relate to the floods and droughts. But in this case, the picture that's been put together is over the oceans, and it relates to the salinity or the fresh water of the oceans. And so it's saying that, you know, the things that we've seen already going on over land, in fact, have a much larger signature. And, of course, this is very important for California. Water is probably one of the key issues and water availability with regard to the California climate. Now, in California, one of the big things that happens in the ocean that affects California is the El Nino phenomenon and La Nina. In the last couple of years, we've been in the La Nina phase, which tends to be drier in California, although I think you may have been lucked out a little bit last year, and it wasn't as dry as Texas, for instance. And the forecast is that we could well go into an El Nino say by late May or June or something like that. And so the prospects for next winter could be completely different, where you do have storms crashing into the coast. And the thing that we then see with both the El Nino and the La Nina phase of what's going on in the Pacific is that the consequences are greater. The droughts tend to be stronger. And then when we get the rainy times, in California's case, in the El Nino conditions, the storms can be more vigorous, and the flooding and the coastal erosion can be even greater. And so those are some of the prospects that we might look for in the next year.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling. Let's take one more call before break. Let's hear from Vivian in Berkeley. Hi, Vivian.
Hi. I agree totally that our climate and weather is just crazy. But I don't know that I believe that they haven't talked about carbon that much. But I think that it needs to be said that scientists are experimenting with our weather, and corporations are experimenting with our weather. And to blame it all on carbon is a very convenient way to cover for this. And I also think that the scientists of the IPCC, people need to look up a website called Climate Gate Analysis by J.P. Costello.
Well, let me ask you, can I just finish? Yes, but I just want to ask you, Vivian, when you say that they're experimenting with the weather, can you be specific?
Okay, well, I don't know if you see the jets going around that are taking away our sunlight. No, it seems so odd that these Climate Gate, the people talking about climate change never mention that when creating clouds, no matter what it is, even if it's water vapor, which I don't believe it is.
All right, we're
no
gonna,
matter what
wait,
it is,
let me get
clouds
a comment just briefly because we're going to go to break in about 30 seconds. Just quick comment, Richard, before we go to break.
Well, I think it's not correct to say that scientists are experimenting with the weather. And people talking about ClimateGate, which is an ugly name for the fact that some private emails of climate scientists were hacked and made public, should also check and notice that many, many investigations have now taken place, and that in all cases, the scientists involved have been cleared, exonerated from all charges of fraud and misdoing.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and you can join us at 866-798-8255, and we will put up emails about that case because that's very important. And we'll be back right after this.
I'm Matt Martin, General Manager of KALW, and I invite you to get up and turn on local public radio Tuesday at 5 p.m. for the Manager's Report to the listeners. We'll get into a conversation about the station's programming and its role in the community, and we want you to get involved. Call in or drop me an email at matt@kalw.org. The Manager's Report, May Day at 5, here on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about Occupy Spring. Tomorrow marks International Workers' Day, or May Day. Unions, labor activists, Occupy groups are planning to take to the streets with a series of actions. So we'll check in with people from around the Northern California area. How is the Occupy movement articulating its demands? And where is the movement today? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the very strange weather we've been seeing. Here in Northern California, we had a mild winter and later than usual rainy season. More than 15,000 daily heat records were broken around the U.S. last month, making 2012 the warmest March since records were first kept in 1895. Last week, New York City broke a 43-year-old daily rainfall record, and then the Boston Marathon issued a dire heat warning before the race recently and said if you're not used to running in the rain, you might want to stay home or watch from the sidelines. And then there were the more than 100 tornadoes hitting the Midwest just a couple weeks ago, costing more than $1 billion. So we're talking about this today with Richard Somerville, climate scientist, professor emeritus, and research professor at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. He's author of The Forgiving Air, Understanding Environmental Change. We're also joined by Kevin Trenberth, senior scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. So Richard, what would you say to people who still think that this is not related to climate change, or this is just natural? Maybe this happened 100 years ago. In fact, I found an article in the Brownsville Herald. Barry Goldsmith, he's a meteorologist for the National Weather Center in Brownsville, Texas. He said, quote, if you look at history, you will see that it shows there have been tornadoes, hailstorms, and snowstorms. But it's probably because there are more people now seeing and videotaping the incidents. And it seems like these events are occurring more often when, in fact, they also occurred hundreds of years ago. And he's a meteorologist saying this. So what would you say to people who are kind of skeptical?
Well, I would say that there's plenty of ways to inform yourself about this. There are books, there are websites, there are the IPCC reports, and one can look into this. So that, for example, people who think that this is just part of a natural cycle, that you'd expect to see this anyway, need to realize that a great deal of research has been done on exactly that issue of separating out things that might occur naturally from things that have unnatural causes, in particular human causes. So that, for example, the sun varies, and the sun does have a huge effect on climate. But now we've been able to put numbers on that. We've made the measurements. So satellites have measured how the variability of the sun is quantitatively. And we find that the sun, over the 11-year sunspot cycle, changes its output by about a 0.1%. And if you convert that to the effect on climate, it's a factor of 10 smaller than that of the carbon dioxide that we're putting out. So does the sun change? Does the sun affect climate? Yes, but quantitatively it fails to explain the effects that we've been seeing now. And a great deal of painstaking and objective research has been done on exactly these issues. And I think that people need to realize that not every meteorologist is an expert on climate science, and not every meteorologist does research on climate change. But the research is there, and it's what has convinced us, those of us who actually do spend our time studying these issues, that we're seeing now the effect of human activities on climate change, and we have every expectation that unless efforts are made to limit the rate at which we emit heat-trapping gases, these effects will become more and more serious and severe in the future.
And Kevin, what would you add to that?
Well, the study you mentioned is actually correct, or the weather guy you mentioned. There are more tornadoes being seen in more places, and it's because there's more people. This applies mainly to the very weak tornadoes, the so-called F1 tornadoes, much less so for the more severe tornadoes. And so it's very hard to get a good idea as to exactly how the climate change is affecting tornadoes. But we have a better understanding if we look more generally at thunderstorms, which the tornadoes are embedded in, and especially rainfall. We've got very good rainfall measurements. And throughout the United States, we have got very good evidence that when it rains harder than it used to, when it rains, it pours, so to speak. And the number for the 48 lower states is something like 20% heavier rains above the top one percentile now than that's the trend throughout the 20th century. And so when it rains harder. There's a greater risk of flooding, and yet the dry spells are also increasing, and so the drought is increasing. So so the effects of climate change are very clear, but the climate records are not always what we would like to see, and natural variability certainly occurs.
All right. Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from Suzanne in Berkeley. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. Thank you so much for your show. Very interesting. I actually work on climate change issues in Southeast Asia and have been doing so for the last 5 years. And we really focus on the intersection between hard science and social science, and in particular trying to help activists influence policy dialogue on these issues. And I'd just like to raise, you know, in the context of the U.S., Rosie made a comment earlier about not having the attention of politicians and political will, and I really feel that in part that's due to the media's failure, you know, to draw a straight line between some of these severe weather events and climate change. I mean, 12 severe weather events in a year is clearly exceeds the norm. It points to climate change rather than oddities in weather. So on the one hand, you know, we have a lot of dramatic coverage and discussions about you know, costs and so forth, but there's never really a clear line drawn to climate change. And then the second piece of that is that scientists really have a responsibility to learn how to talk to the general public in language that they can understand. The science is really complicated. It's hard to absorb. But I do think, frankly, that there's been a failure on the part of the scientific community to effectively reach out, you know, in ways that are accessible to the average person. But so those are my two comments. I'd love to hear more from your guests.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm so glad you brought this up, because Media Matters just came out with a study last week that found coverage of climate change on ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox has dropped significantly since 2009. Last year, these networks spent more than twice as much time discussing Donald Trump as they did discussing climate change. A very sad fact there. They also found that the Sunday shows featured more Republicans than Democrats on climate change, and they're finding that climate deniers are getting almost twice as much airtime as scientists. So, Richard, with that in mind, and then Suzanne had a really good question saying maybe the climate change groups and organizations aren't doing a very good job to really get the message out to speak to average people on this issue.
I think that your caller has raised some really important points, and I agree that the coverage in the media, the mass media, mainstream media, has been less than what one would hope for, and part of that has to do simply with the fact that there are fewer reporters on that beat. There are fewer journalists covering science in general, and newsrooms have shrunk, and there's fewer people on the climate change issue and fewer who have some real expertise and experience on it. Your caller also mentioned that the scientific community could do a better job of speaking out in ways that are intelligible and that make sense to non-specialists, and I very much agree. And several of us, and Kevin and myself are among that group, are trying to make a change in that. We are making efforts to help scientists who want to speak out, who want to testify to Congress and want to speak to journalists, to do a better job of it. Because, you know, we scientists weren't born with communication skills. It's a little bit like skiing. You have to take lessons and you have to learn how to do it. And I think it can be done. We don't yet have a group of scientists in this country who are really expert in making the scientific findings intelligible to a broad public. It's not a question of dumbing down or being disparaging or patronizing. You're talking to intelligent people who simply don't speak the language of jargon and mathematics that research scientists use every day. And the task of translating scientific findings into things that are interesting and intelligible, that have stories, that have human interest, that are clear to the broad public and to policymakers, is a big task, and I think one that does require more attention.
And what do you think, Kevin? Because you do have two big tasks. One is getting your message out there to a large audience, and then you have to actually be in the media, because this Media Matters study shows that on the Sunday shows in 2011, there were zero scientists talking about climate change.
I thought the caller made some excellent points, and I agree with them entirely, and Richard has also elaborated on that, and I agree with his points. It's very disappointing to see when there are major events that occur, such as the droughts and the heat waves and the floods, and, you know, recently there was a Discovery Channel article dealing with ice, and somehow, none of these even mention climate change or the fact that the climate is changing and playing a role in these things. And so there is some avoidance of this by the media, which I find very unfortunate, but it seems to be related to politics, and it relates to the Tea Party and some of the rhetoric that has occurred. The Republican Party has been very much a part of this, where the none of the presidential candidates on the Republican side have stepped up and said that, indeed, climate change is a real problem that we need to address. And I think that is extremely unfortunate and completely at odds with all of the facts. So some of this does relate to politics and funding, and it needs to change.
And also, we tend to have this sort of balance, those who believe in climate change and those who don't, and that's the conversation we hear. Richard, you spend half of your year in France. What is the media coverage of the environment and climate change look like in France and across Europe?
I think, in my experience, it's more balanced. That is to say, you don't have this strong connection in European countries, and in fact, most of the world in general, between political viewpoints and opinions about science. You don't have the analog to what we have in this country, which is that polling data shows that increasingly the people who take climate change seriously and who accept the mainstream science tend to be Democrats, and the people who are in denial about the reality of climate change and don't recognize the human influence on it tend to be Republicans. There's a kind of partisan divide here that is increasing, and it's shown in the behavior in Congress and among presidential candidates as well, and you don't see that elsewhere in the world. So that, for example, in France, the government of President Sarkozy is a right-of-center government, and I think you would characterize the Merkel government in Germany and the Cameron government in England as that way as well. But all of those people and their governments take climate change seriously. At least they don't make public pronouncements saying that the science is wrong or scientists are fraudulent. And so I'm afraid that in this country we've come to the point now where this is a highly politicized topic, and so that if you find out how somebody votes, you pretty much know what their views on the science are likely to be. My view on this is that one ought to be able to separate science and policy. There aren't any Republican or Democratic thermometers. There aren't any liberal or conservative satellites. And we ought to be able to come to agreement on what the science says and talk about that in an objective and intelligent, mutually respectful way, and then bring in the values and economics and priorities when we come to discuss policy. But the science itself ought to be divorced from politics.
And that is Richard Somerville, climate scientist, professor emeritus, and research professor at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego, and author of The Forgiving Air, Understanding Environmental Change. We're also joined by Kevin Trenberth, senior scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. And thanks again for calling in, Suzanne. Let's go next to Judy in Redwood City. Hi, Judy.
Good morning. So I have several points that I'll try to make briefly and clear. So one, I think each of us need to take individual responsibility, one, to try to get educated on this, and two, how to walk our talk about treating the earth better. And then the next point is how to communicate effectively, because yes, for the scientists to learn, but also for us one-on-one and within our communities and in using the media and in politics, like how to, once we know the information, how to affect other people's behavior with, you know, our words and our knowledge. And with the media, there's a big concern because of it being a corporate-owned, especially in the middle of the United States. People don't have access to information, which is something that our dollars can help to vote for when we go to buy things, support like public radio and such like that. But also, if we have a corporation that's shutting down the words on global warming, not to support that corporation. This other thrivemovement.com was about following the money to how it affects our politics, how the very, very private money, very high up. Thrivemovement.com is something to look at. The other thing is our cultural values. The Christianity in our country, seeing God one place and earth another versus the Native American viewpoint where we're all one, if people could affect religion to seeing it as a caregiving thing to treat the earth with respect.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Judy. We'll get responses after I take a few more calls. Let's hear from Amber in Santa Cruz. Hi, Amber.
Thank you for this wonderful show and the great work that you're doing.
Thank you.
I recently happened to have a conversation. I was traveling with a professor emeritus from in physics from one of the Arizona universities, and we were talking about climate change, and he mentioned that it's possibly being influenced by the changes in the Earth's gravitation and that the poles are shifting. And I wonder if you have any comments on that.
All right, on polar shifts. Thank you. We'll get to that in just a minute. Let's hear first from Lydia in Santa Cruz. Hi, Lydia.
Yes, hi. I want to thank a previous caller who raised the question of chemtrails and contrails. Chemtrails are not contrails. Chemtrails are over 100 miles long. They spread all over the sky in California, and they more recently turn into sort of buttermilk sky and look innocent, but they have been there for years. They're perfectly obvious, and the question arises in the film called Why, What in the World Are They Spraying on Us? That the San Francisco Chronicle is completely impossible when it comes to the public raising the issue of what is happening when our skies are dimmed and where is our weather being sent. There is the possibility that California weather is being shunted by having been cooled off by these chemtrails eastward. Now, this is not a denial of climate change. I have been a full supporter of climate change theory and concept and research for years. But we must take a look at what is happening to skies.
Well, thank you for calling in. We have a few emails about this. A lot of people said, why did you cut Vivian off earlier? I was going to actually bring her back after the break, but she hung up. So we were going to have her back. But so, Kevin, what are your thoughts about what is up there in the sky, the white streak we see?
Well, I mean, there are some good points. Both of those were very good points, that it's not just carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is one of the byproducts of human activity, so it's increased by about 40% since pre-industrial times, and it's increased about 20% since the 1970s, and the rate of increase is going up even further, especially as China and India are industrializing. And so carbon dioxide, one of the greenhouse gases, is an important effect, but so is all other kinds of pollution. Now, the other kinds of pollution tends to be a lot more local, and so this relates to cloudiness, and we're even beginning to see some signs of some of the industrial activity over China is coming across the Pacific and influencing California, for instance. And so there is some air pollution that makes it all the way across. Normally, the visible air pollution gets washed out of the atmosphere with weather systems. That's why you get spots on your car after you've cleaned it. And that works actually quite well, but it still takes on average about 5 to 7 days for that to happen. And so as we put more and more stuff into the atmosphere, it begins to have more of an effect, and it can affect clouds. And that's one of the big research topics as to how important that is, especially with regard to local climate change. Just a quick comment on one of the other points that was mentioned about gravitation and the poles shifting.
Right.
You know, there is a very tiny measurable effect of that. We can measure it, especially when we have El Nino effects, and it relates to the strength of the overall winds. It changes the length of day, for instance, by about a nanosecond or slightly more than that. It is measurable, but in terms of real effects on the climate, it is not of any consequence. And just going back to one of the other callers, individual responsibility, communication, and she also mentioned the role of money super PACs. We're seeing that now. You know, I think that is a very important consideration on all of this, and we need to recognize that vested interests exist.
And Richard, do you have anything to add on the various questions we got?
I think we got some really good questions, and I wish we had more time so that we could go into them in detail. I wanted to send along two websites, two links that I think your listeners might find very helpful. One of them is called skepticalscience.com. The skeptical science, all one word with a K for skepticalscience.com. It's a website run by an Australian physicist named John Cook, which has turned out to be a very useful compilation of many objections often raised by climate contrarians. Why is it really warming or not? And is it just due to poorly sighted thermometers in the urban heat islands or not? And so on. Or is it the sun? And I think these questions have long been answered, and Cook's site, skepticalscience.com, provides a very useful compilation of the clear science that shows the correct answers to those questions. The other site that I think many of your listeners would like to hear, especially those who have talked about the communication issue, is called climatecommunication.org, climatecommunication, all one word, .org. That's a site run by an American expert in communicating climate science named Susan Hassel. Both Kevin Trenberth and I are advisors to that effort, and climatecommunication.org has a lot of clear information on climate science and on how to do a better job of communicating it. And I think many of your listeners might find that helpful as well.
Okay, great. Thank you. And we'll put links on our website right after the show. I also wanted to ask you both about a piece that just ran in Forbes called Eating Less Meat is World's Best Chance for Timely Climate Change. And they quote Robert Goodland. He's a former World Bank Group environmental advisor. And back in 2006, he reported that 18% of worldwide greenhouse gas emissions were attributable to cattle, buffalo, sheep, goats, camels, pigs, and poultry, although they just updated this study and they found that figure to be about 51%. So what are your thoughts on this? We've heard the UN has come out with studies about the relationship between greenhouse gases and animal production. Kevin, what are your thoughts? It's kind of amazing to see this headline in Forbes. really.
Yes, I know. I think it's a little bit out of context, though. I mean, it relates to the whole issue of sustainability of everything that we do on the planet. And it's not as if all of the grasslands and cereals that the cattle eat are really available for humans to eat. It's not that simple. And one way of thinking about a cow is that it's a way of storing that for a time when you actually want to use it later. So I think that kind of a study is somewhat oversimplified, but it is correct that more people can probably live as vegetarians than as omnivores or meat eaters. And and so I'll just leave it at that.
And Richard, anything to add? Because this is getting a lot of attention.
Well, I think it's important. I think that this issue deserves more attention, because what's happening as the world industrializes and as developing countries with large populations like China and India take on, you might say, the lifestyles and habits of Western nations that are already rich, we do see a greater conversion from a more vegetarian diet to a more meat-centered diet, and that has many, many downsides, and production of greenhouse gases is among them, but by no means the only one. I think one of the issues here that politicians don't mention, because it's too much of a hot potato, but which people like me who are not running for office are free to talk about, is the issue of population. Mm-hmm. We're now at more than 7 billion people on this planet, mm-hmm. and during one human lifetime, that number has more than tripled, and that's a direct multiplier. And it's much harder to have a sustainable planet with 10 billion people than when it was 2 billion people, which was early in the 20th century. So
right.
I think these issues deserve a great deal more attention. The Dalai Lama has recently said that he favored non-coercive methods of decreasing fertility, such as, and he was joking, more nuns and monks like himself.
Well, we've got just about 30 seconds left. Kevin, final thoughts from you. What can we expect in the next 6 months, next year, when it comes to weather changes?
Well, we can certainly expect more of the same. The main memory of the climate change is in the oceans. The oceans have warmed mm-hmm. up. It speeds up the hydrological cycle, and the effects will certainly be uneven. You know, we can speculate, where is it that's going to be the hot spot this year, but almost certainly there will be one somewhere.
All right. Well, we'll definitely continue to follow this. Thank you so much, Kevin Trenberth, senior scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Richard Somerville, climate scientist, research professor at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego, and author of The Forgiving Air, Understanding Environmental Change. Thank you both for joining us.
You're welcome.
And thanks for your phone calls and emails. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What do you want from Occupy Spring? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the Occupy movement and International Workers' Day, May Day. Unions, Labor Day activists, and Occupy groups are planning to take to the streets with a series of May Day actions. Longshoremen have called for a daytime work stoppage at the Port of Oakland. So where is the Occupy movement today? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. How is Occupy articulating its demands? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.